Dear listener, this is the Audita podcast, Voices of Earth. This podcast is all about music, and more specifically about choir music. It's a podcast in which you will meet the Helsinki-based Audita Chamber Choir, founded in 1992 by the conductor Jani Siveen, who still today remains the artistic director of the choir. The podcast is produced in celebration of Audita's 30th anniversary. Audita is a chamber choir consisting of professional musicians and serious music amateurs, and it is a rather peculiar choir in that we have several professional composers among our own singers. For our anniversary concert tour, Voices of Earth, six new choir pieces were commissioned by our very own composers: Alex Freeman, Anna Huuskonen, Markku Klami, Finn Shields, Jani Siveen, and Matthew Whittle. In this podcast series, you will meet them all and hear their thoughts on music, composing, and choir singing. And we will also dive into the theme for the anniversary concerts, nature. In this episode, I will be talking to composer Matthew Whittle, who has been referred to as, among other things, Canada's gift to Finland, I believe, whose music has been referred to as accessible but never banal, which I personally felt characterizes your music really well. I hope you don't mind me saying that.
I believe it's been called banal on occasion, but oh, you know, that's okay. Well, it's canceled out by the people who didn't call it banal.
No, I think the people who said it's never banal were much more right.
I like them better.
Me too. Welcome.
Thank you.
Of course, being a psychologist, I want to start with your childhood. Tell us, how did music come to play a role in your childhood?
I remember it as kind of always being around as just a facet in our family. I'm the youngest of four siblings by quite a bit. All my siblings are quite a bit older than me. And my older brothers and sister took music lessons. We grew up in quite a small town, so we didn't really have professional music teachers. Everybody was sort of an amateur. And imitating my older brothers, I studied violin and piano a little bit when I was between the ages of about 4 to 6. And was quite resistant to learning to read notation and came into conflict with the teachers at that point. So my parents thought the best idea was to just let it drop. And I kind of let go of the lessons, which is sad. And I think a professional music teacher would have thought, gee, I have a 5-year-old who's improvising at the piano. Maybe I should do something about that.
That would be different today.
Things would be different, but it was the 70s in small town Quebec in Canada. Yeah. So, people didn't really think that way about teaching. I think in Finland, things would have gone quite a bit differently for me as a young musical kid, but it was just always in the air. And I grew up more or less self-taught as a player of several instruments and went through high school playing in a wind band program where I played several wind instruments, including saxophone and tuba and euphonium. And I finally settled on the French horn eventually. So that was my path through music. But I played recorder. I sang at a seasonal pickup choir at our church. I grew up Catholic, and it was a small congregation. And the organist was a very close friend of my parents who taught with them. They were all school teachers. And so she would put together a pickup choir every Christmas. And I would join in and sing. And I would do, the occasional solos because I had a nice alto voice as a kid and would sing solos on Christmas Eve and things like that. So it was just, it was all very homespun and amateur and informal.
Which is probably a good thing for creativity.
Possibly, yeah. I got to university being musical but not knowing anything about music and barely able to read it.
Interesting.
So it was a really unusual path, I think, towards becoming a professional classical musician.
How come when did you know that you want to be a classical or like a professional musician?
Sometime in high school, I think. I just got very involved in the wind band program at my high school, and I really enjoyed, I think that's where it really lit up for me, was ensemble playing, playing with other people and the camaraderie and the sense of fitting into a larger whole. That was really it for me. And I just decided that I set out wanting to be a French horn player. Oh. That was my principal instrument, and that's what I wanted to do for any number of years until my early 20s, and so that was my goal as a performer.
So when you started studying you started studying music immediately after school?
Or? After high school, yeah. I auditioned for a small but quite widely renowned music school in Montreal called Vanier College, or it was a general college that had a fantastic music program that's quite well known throughout Canada for the intensity of its academics, actually, theory and ear training and musicianship in general. And I didn't really even know one end of the horn from the other. But for whatever reason, they decided I was musical enough to take a chance on. And I started remedial courses. And that's when I really got into music. I started learning about music and learning how it's put together and all of the technical aspects thereof. Mm. And actually, it wasn't until my second year at college when I had to start taking piano, which I did reluctantly as a second instrument. I thought it was taking time away from my horn studies. But I fell in with a piano teacher named Earl Wilson, who's still a really close friend of mine. He was about 20 years older than me. And after a couple of lessons of watching me sort of flail through these little Kabalevsky and Clementi sonatinas, realized that I was probably more interested in music than I was in learning to play the piano. And so in the next lesson, he came in with two books of music. One was Schubert's Impromptus, and one was Debussy's first book of preludes. And of course, I was nowhere near the technique that I needed to play any of these pieces. I'd had some keyboard harmony classes. But he just proceeded to teach me to play Schubert and Debussy over the course of a year. And that was really transformative for me. I fell in love with the richness of that music. And in a certain sense, it also spoiled me off my horn career because I realized that, wow, this music is way better than the stuff that horn players get to play. It's so much better. And then I just started exploring piano repertoire, and that's kind of how I fell into being a composer, actually. Mm.
But composing, did you start doing that already earlier? Or, I mean, you said you were improvising at the age of five, but when were you starting to do pieces that you would remember or later on, I guess, write down?
Probably when I was around 19. Yeah. I didn't really write my first piece until I was 19, and it was with no intent of becoming a composer. Mm. I was going to be a performer. That's what I was going to do. But I wrote a piece for choir. My first piece was for choir, actually, because I had joined the wind band at my college was pretty terrible and quite small and missing parts and stuff. But we had a really good choir. And so I joined the choir because I hadn't sung in a choir in years. And I've always taken a very, I guess that's where my attitude towards composing came from. I always write for what I have to hand. I'm not going to write an orchestra piece and shove it in a drawer that never gets played. I'm going to write music that gets played, gets performed. So I wrote a piece for the choir and the conductor did it. And the attention and respect that she lavished on it kind of spoiled me for any kind of interaction with professional musicians later, because she treated me like a real composer. She didn't treat me dismissively like a student. And so I got that piece performed. Mm. It was a piece for double choir, wordless double choir and piano. And that's kind of how I realized that, oh, maybe I could do this composing thing. It wasn't a very good piece, but it was pretty. Mm. And a few years later, after my performance career kind of ran up against the wall of years of bad physical technique and muscle tension and problems that just made it impossible for me to play anymore and without major physical reconstruction and work, I started thinking more seriously about composing and decided to do a degree in that. And here I am.
And where did you do that degree?
At that point, I was living in the U.S. I'd gone there to study horn at the University of Massachusetts, which is not a very well-known performance school, but they had a fantastic horn teacher named Laura Clock, who was just an incredible musician, and I really wanted to learn from her. And she had this very nurturing attitude towards teaching. She was like everybody's mom. She was a wonderful teacher. And I started taking composition lessons a bit more seriously. And again, I was writing for the things I had to hand. So I wrote a piece for choir and wind orchestra that got performed at University of Massachusetts and a couple of other smaller things. And when I really got into composition, I went to Stony Brook University in Long Island, New York, which is, again, another small school, very good scholarship program. And that was kind of the making of me, because it was very, very hands-off with regard to style. They didn't force anybody to write a specific kind of music. Mm-hmm. It was just, they were really interested in helping you figure out what you wanted to do, the kind of music you wanted to write. And that's where I did my master's degree.
Yeah. And now you're sitting here in Helsinki and singing in Audite. What happened between then and now?
The long story short is I had wanted to come to Europe for a number of years to study. And Finland ended up just being one of the more attractive places. I think at that time, actually, I was working night shifts in the music library at Stony Brook. Hmm. And all of this Finnish music was starting to come out on disc. And my job was to prepare arriving CDs for pre-cataloging. I wasn't a cataloger, but I would just, you know, file an intake form of this and this CD. And so there wasn't much to do in the evening shift. So I put on CDs and listened to it. And I was listening to Kaija Saariaho and Kalev Jaho and Magnus Lindberg and all of these composers who were coming out thinking, wow, this music is awesome. And I really wanted to write orchestra music. And I was looking at the Finnish scene thinking, obviously, orchestral music is really important there. So I thought seriously about that. And I found a very obscure Canadian government scholarship to send one student to Finland every year. And I think I might have been the only person who applied for it because it was days and days of internet searching to find a reference to this scholarship. And I came here in 2001 on that scholarship. And how I ended up singing in choirs was my colleague Alex Freeman had written a choral piece, I think in our second year here, that had been picked up by a choir conductor we knew because we'd sung a concert or two with him, Esko Kallio, and his student choir, the Holo Choir. And Alex had joined that choir and said, hey, this is really great. So I went to their concert and I heard that piece. I think it was O Magnum Mysterium, which I have now sung hundreds of times, literally, over the last 20 years. And I thought, well, that choir sounds really good. And I asked Esko if I could join. And he said, yeah, sure. So we need basses. He was a bit disappointed that my voice had gone up in register after my return to choir singing. I used to be a low bass. And then after singing again for a little while as an adult, I was a baritone. So I ended up in the first bass section. And choral singing became a huge part of my life, a really welcome part of my life, because I realized that I still missed performing.
Yeah.
When I left performing behind, I didn't feel like a complete musician anymore. Mm. And choir scratched that itch.
And now you get to perform your own music with your own choir. How does that feel?
It's always an interesting process. Because by the time my piece comes before, you know, my friends in the choir, I'm already sick of it. Mm. It's exciting to hear people sing it for the first time, of course, because you want to see if you got everything right. But also it's just, I'm utterly sick of the music. So, but you have to live with it for another year or two, as the choir picks up the piece. So it's an interesting dichotomy that way of it's utterly new to everybody but me. And of course it remakes the piece in my imagination too, to hear people perform it because, you know, I don't always get everything right. My batting average tends to be in the 97% range, I think, but there are always little things that didn't occur to you, even after 20, 30 years of writing choral music.
Well, does that always go in the sort of negative direction, or are there things that surprise you positively?
Always, yeah. I mean, there are certain things of, oh, you know, I didn't think of that particular connection between those two words, but that lined up really nicely, didn't it? Mm-hmm. Or so it's always a mixed thing.
Yeah. And I've been thinking during this project also that I would probably feel it quite gratifying to see people really enjoy singing music that I have composed, like seeing what it really gives your friends around you who you are singing with and who fall in love with your music.
It is gratifying. And that's one of the gratifying things about writing choral music in general. I've written quite a bit of orchestral music at this point because that's what I wanted to do. Mm. Choral music was just a thing where I ended up in Finland and nobody cared who I was and nobody was interested in my music except this choir that I sang in for years and years. And so all I did was write music for my choir for the most part.
Well, that certainly has changed over these years.
I've since moved into orchestral music. That was a really gratifying shift. Mm. But it's a different ethos. You get performed by an orchestra and you're just the guy they're playing that week. And they will do it with consummate professionalism and dedication and then forget about you completely because then they have to move on. Whereas choirs really take ownership of a piece and it keeps cycling back into their repertoire again and again if they like the piece. And I think that's the greatest thing about doing it as a composer is that connection that choirs feel to the music you've written for them.
Yes, absolutely. about composing as a process, how does it go? Do you hear it or do you just start, you know, playing the piano and
exploring? I actually don't. I'm not very attached to notes.
Yeah.
When I start out. And that's sort of evolved over the years where I don't sketch very much as a composer. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I don't sketch at all anymore because I found early on that I just got lost in the detail and the possibilities, and it made it too hard to make choices for me. So I kind of sit down and basically what I've done since I was 4 or 5, I sit down and improvise.
Mm. On the piano or singing or?
Piano, singing, whatever it is. Mm. But mainly what I'm hearing, so-called, when I start a piece is musical behaviors, how I want the music to go in a very general way. And then it becomes a question of finding the right notes to make that happen.
Mm.
And it's in a way, I'm very picky about the notes. Actually, it takes me a long time to find the right notes, but in a certain sense, they're immaterial because it's just a group of notes that I've chosen to give that the sound, the behavior that I want. Choral music, of course, is very different. I mean, I hear kinds of music very quickly when I see a text. I'll know immediately how it should go.
Mm.
And I tend to have a really instinctive feel about texts. When I read them, sometimes I'll just pick up a text and go, no, I can't set that. And other times I'll pick it up and immediately hear a specific kind of music that I feel would bring out the best in that text.
Mm.
Instrumental music is a bit harder for me, actually, because I find that text actually stirs musical impulses more easily. And the text demands its own kind of music. And I'm just responding to that in a way, and not in a passive way, but I think the text really creates its own form. It suggests music, whereas instrumental music is, I mean, you're kind of all on your own. You've got to just find something that works. And so that's a trickier process for me, but I still have to do it. So I do it.
If we come back a little bit to childhood, was there some piece or some moment, musical moment that was particularly important for you? Or what are maybe the musical pieces that have really felt that this is, you know, bigger than life?
Not so much in my childhood, because it was all like a big nebulous cloud of music. When I got to university, I didn't really understand that there were periods of music and development. It was all contemporary to me in a way. It was all new. And it took me a couple of years to sort that all out. But I guess the most formative memory for me was the first time I heard a symphony orchestra, which was quite late. I went to hear the Montreal Symphony. And I bought like a nosebleed ticket, you know, way up in the back of the hall. And I was probably about 18 years old. And they opened the concert with the second suite from Maurice Ravel's Daphnis et Chloé, which opens with this magnificent sunrise. And it was one of their calling cards as an orchestra, that piece. And I just remember the sound of that music filling the hall. And I thought, in a way, that's where the idea probably hit me of becoming a composer, because I really wanted to do that. And I would say another central piece was a little bit earlier in high school when one of my brothers gave me a copy, again, of the Montreal Symphony's recording of Holst's The Planets. And that was a really formative experience for me of just hearing that magnificent music. Oh, I wore out that tape. I just killed it. I had to buy a new copy eventually. But that was really, again, a really seminal experience.
Mm.
And I think it's an important piece for me because the music of it, when you look at it, is really polystylistic. Wagnerian romanticism, early impressionism, English pastoralism, it's all in this one gigantic piece. And it never occurred to me that you shouldn't do that at any point. And so that, I think, formed a lot of how my attitude towards composition and style, that I'm free to mix all of these things, because why wouldn't I? These people did it. Mm. I mean, these were important pieces for me. And if it was okay for them, then it's okay for me. It wasn't until much later that I ran into that aesthetic dogma that plagues new music about what you should and should not write.
Mm.
And by then I had a kind of a lot of armor against that.
And where would you like to go as a composer? What are your dreams or plans, hopes for the coming years?
Honestly, I don't know. I've tried to renounce professional goals recently because I've been disappointed in a certain number of them recently. So I'm trying not to get too attached to what kind of composer I want to be, what kind of music I want to write, and just more taking satisfaction in the process of writing it. But in general, I would like to get into opera. I've written a lot of vocal music. I like working with text. Opera can be a frustrating medium. I remember asking the American composer Nico Muhly about this when I met him a few years ago, because he writes quite a bit of opera. I said, "What's it like in a nutshell?" And he said, "Girl, it'll take years off your life, but if you love it, you got to do it." And I think that's probably everybody I've talked to about opera says roughly the same thing. Uh-huh. It's a challenging and frustrating medium uh-huh. to work in, but really rewarding. So I think I would like to try my hand at that before I drop dead.
Yeah, it sounds like you have years of frustration and hopefully a lot of reward ahead of you. Well, looking forward to hearing that and looking very much forward to singing this fantastic piece that you have composed for the Audite 30-year anniversary with the concert Voices of Earth. And we will soon continue discussing this piece together with your longtime friend and colleague, Alex Freeman. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Now we will discuss Matthew Whittle's piece, The Geography of Hope. This piece starts with the slightly surprising words, "Dear Mr. Pesonen," which of course is a very Finnish-sounding family name. Can you tell us about this text, how you found it and how you decided that this was the text you wanted to use for this composition?
Okay, well, how I found it, to cut a longer story short, was that I was going to set a completely different text for this project, a text by Carl Sagan called The Pale Blue Dot Speech, because I really wanted to do something that would contextualize the smallness of humanity and the earth in the larger stream of creation. I thought, wow, nobody's ever set that text. That would be a great project. And then I found out later when I inquired about the rights that the reason nobody's ever set it is that nobody gets the rights to set Carl Sagan's text to music. It's not allowed. So I was left high and dry and needing a text for this project. And I went back to this text by the American writer and conservationist Wallace Stegner, which is called Wilderness Letter. It was published he wrote it in 1960, and it was published as part of his writings later in that decade. And I had read it before, but I came back to it with fresh eyes, and it really struck me as being exactly right for this project. Of course, it's a personal letter to Mr. David Pesonen, who was, or Pesonen probably, as it was pronounced in the U.S. at that point, who was a government official in charge of a commission on conservation. And he was just writing to this person saying, this is the value of maintaining wilderness. Of course, this is like in the forefront of conservation efforts in the mid-20th century. This is not, you know, we think of it as current thought, but back then it was like a whole different idea. And so he was just writing very poetically about the value of maintaining wilderness and what it means for us. And the wildernesses he writes about are things that we would not necessarily consider as obviously beautiful. He wasn't writing about the Rocky Mountains or Big Sur in California. He was writing about the desert. He was writing about the prairie. He was writing about really extreme environments, things that we wouldn't necessarily consider conventionally beautiful, but still have great value. And I think that's actually kind of a link between my piece and Alex's too. What Stegner is talking about is less conventionally beautiful landscapes, the things that people wouldn't normally associate with natural beauty, not obviously so. And I think that's a connection between my piece and Alex Freeman's that we're going to discuss later, that both of our texts refer to less obviously beautiful things about nature.
Mm. Indeed. And actually, we do have Alex Freeman with us here today to discuss Matthew's piece.
Excellent.
Welcome, Alex.
Thank you.
But before we continue this discussion, this text is really incredibly beautiful, and it would be great to hear a small excerpt of this. It's impressive, I think, that it's a letter, because it's really written in such a poetic way. But could you, Matthew, please read a small part of this letter or the text that you've set to music?
I can. Actually, the poetic form is entirely created by me. So it's just a series of clips from this letter. And I was limited to 300 words of the letter. So I was forced to create a form for it and to choose very carefully which words I was going to use and when. So the part I'm going to read is from the second part of my piece when Stegner writes about the desert. The desert, a lovely and terrible wilderness, harshly and beautifully colored, open and scarred, broken and worn, its great sky without a smudge of taint from technocracy, and in hidden corners the sudden poetry of springs. The extractable wealth is taken, and the shafts, the tailings, and the ruins left. The tracks, the scars, the wounds men make in the earth do not quickly heal. Better a wounded wilderness than none at all.
This does strike one as incredibly modern, or like it really could be written
current
today.
Yeah, I think so.
Alex, would you like to comment on Matthew's piece? I think it, also in the music, it depicts really, really beautifully these different landscapes, these different aspects of both the beauty of the nature and the sort of sadness of what we are doing to it. But Alex, please.
Yeah, well, it's such a quintessentially Matthew Whittle kind of piece, I think. I mean that in the absolute best kind of way, because as I think he's aware, we've known each other for many years. And I think what this piece does amazingly is it's some kind of wizardry. There are these moments of stasis that I really associate with his musical vision, but also a very clear procession of a musical argument that goes from beginning to end. In such a short piece, he fills these moments of reflection with really unhurried time. He's taken this letter and chosen some of the most beautiful images from it. He's done this incredible tap dance around the restrictions of only being able to use 300 words of it, choose just the right words, and to put them in just the right order. But I mean, I think he should get some royalties as the poet in this.
I opted not to do that because it was a fairly protracted negotiation with the estate to get the permission to do it at all. And they wanted me originally to set a 300-word chunk of it. And I said, look, I can't do that. There is no 300-word continuous section of this letter that is settable as music. So you're just going to have to trust me that I know what I'm doing and I'm not going to distort the meaning of what Mr. Stegner wanted. So,
It beautifully depicts the meaning of these really very poetic lines. For example, the small animals that come out, and it's sort of funny to see them, and then it turns into this.
Yeah.
It turns into this like heart-bleeding sentiment of, you know, every death of these creatures or of these parts of nature is a loss in us. It's a little death in me.
It's nice that Alex says it's quintessentially me, but I was actually trying to be him in writing this piece. At this point, for some reason, I just got really sick of my usual way of approaching text, of approaching even harmony. And every time I reapproach this piece, I kept thinking, what would Alex do? Where would Alex go from this chord? I'm sick of the way I hear this going. How would Alex move from out of this particular harmony? How would Alex conceive of this text? And it really kind of refreshed my approach to choral composition.
Oh, this is really interesting to hear, knowing both of you and both of yours music. Alex, what
That's
do you
interesting.
Think?
Yeah, because we talked about these pieces while we were working on them, and it didn't really occur to me so much until now that we were solving a lot of the same kinds of problems. At least in my case, I had this poem, and I'm intentionally entering this sort of nebulous territory. Like, I'm going to use some of these lines more than once. I'm not sure which ones, and I'm not sure when, but I'm going to, you know, for me, I can juggle some things, but Matt is sort of forced into kind of, taking these words and building a new poem out of them. I guess it is very much interesting to hear you wrestling with that in your own way. And it's funny. No, I think it sounds, it's wall-to-wall Whittle when I sing it anyway. And it's also, by the way, splendid to sing. Just speaking as a composer, I mean, it's so pro from beginning to end, like the voice leading and the writing for the voice and everything. It's just, a 10-minute choir piece is actually a pretty long choir piece.
It's a big chunk of music to have to write. I mean, it's especially if you're doing it in one continuous thought. It's one thing to do a little song cycle, but 10 minutes of choral music is tough.
Mm. Yeah,
it's not like 10 minutes of instrumental.
No, and this
music.
Is also as a story it progresses. It like the landscape changes so much, so it's really like a small movie or a mini opera. I wouldn't. Yeah. I don't know what the writer.
I mean, of course, when we're writing, we're not doing this continuously, and you're not really thinking necessarily that far ahead of how am I going to get to here from here. I just thought I have these two ideas. I have the prairie in the first part of my piece, and I have the desert, and I kind of had ideas for both of those. And then it just became a question of how am I going to connect it. And at a certain point, I actually connected it backwards. I couldn't figure out how to get from halfway through the first section into the second section, and so I wrote backwards from the second section, chord by chord.
Wow. Okay, interesting. I think from also now singing in a Finnish choir in Finland, where we're very used to, of course, having nature as a core theme, which I guess is quite universal, but the core themes of our nature are very different from the nature you're depicting here. And the same goes for Alex's piece, which I think adds to its fascination. It's like not the typical nature landscapes at all.
Well, they're different for me. I mean, I grew up in the east coast of Canada, not even really the east coast, inner east of Canada. I'd never seen a prairie until I was about 12. I've never been near a desert in my life. So a lot of it is imagined for me through what Stegner wrote.
Yeah, same here. I've to this day never, unless you count the Canary Islands, I've never been to a real desert.
I don't think it counts.
Desert-like.
Fuerteventura is pretty desert-like. That was impressive.
Now North Carolina has a lot of things, but it doesn't have desert.
Well, the theme of this whole concert series was nature, which of course gives very different opportunities to choose your texts from and your angle from, and these compositions in the series are indeed very different. Tell us, Matthew, about your reflections on this theme, what you wanted to sort of bring up.
Well, I mean, originally when we started this project, it was just sort of nature as an open theme, and then it gradually mutated into this more environmental concern. Mm. And for me, that was a little bit uncomfortable because nature kind of forms the core of what I've done. My dad was a teacher in his professional life, but he was also a landscape painter. And he was a huge fan of a group of Canadian painters known as the Group of Seven, who were very central to Canadian landscape art in the early 20th century. And took me to tons of exhibits, and I'm a lifelong hiker and camper. It's something that my father and I did together my whole childhood. And so I grew up with a really close relationship with nature, and that sort of formed the core of my ethos as an artist, of wanting to translate and update nature imagery for contemporary use in music. And so in current times, when I feel like that theme has been politicized to a certain extent, it's a difficult subject for me, and I've actually read papers and articles recently about how basically if you're not writing about environmental degradation and climate crisis, your music, like, it's not relevant to be writing about nature unless you're doing that. And I have a pretty big problem with that attitude because I take a much wider view of the problem. I'm much more hopeful about it for certain things. I don't think technology is necessarily an evil. I think it's a bell you can't unring. And things like, you know, shaming people about flying, about their consumption, I think is really a sort of, it's not for us to do. And so in my piece, I wanted to take an angle on it that presented that degradation, that presented those problematics in a more hopeful light.
Mm.
And for me, that line that I ended on in this excerpt, better a wounded wilderness than none at all, I think that's the real central line in the text for me. That yes, we have made huge mistakes as a species in our stewardship of the environment, of the planet we're bound to, but that doesn't mean that we can't come back from that. And I think that a lot of current art spends a lot of its time hectoring the audience about that, and I don't think that that's productive.
Mm.
And I mean, it kind of gets me choked up. Like I get very passionate about this because I really think it's just not for us as artists to make the audience feel bad about our individual choices in a piece of art. And so I wanted to frame those choices within a piece that offers a path forward, that offers a different way of thinking about those choices and how we can recover and take on a greater role of stewardship.
Yeah, I think for me also, it's a similar feeling that I think it's important to reflect on what it is that we're trying to save. I think it's not that I don't think that some works of art you know, maybe have the role of Hector in the audience. So I think, especially with climate change, it has been that the audience has been pretty hostile to seeing the reality of it, and maybe they needed some Hectoring. But it shouldn't be that every piece of art about nature and about climate change, the role of it is to make everybody feel like we're all doomed and we're all going to die. There's a little bit of opportunism there, I think, that you're always trying to one-up despair, and I'm not sure that it's useful. I would rather, for instance, in my, you know, the work that I usually do, I think reflecting on the thing that is valuable in a way can be more of a motivator to look at these beautiful things that we have and look what, you know, this amazing earth that we live on. And it's not an original approach. I mean, basically, David Attenborough does this. He shows you the world's wonders and at the end of every episode says, all of this is going away because we're not taking care of it.
Mm.
And I think that can be the message, but I don't think that all art needs to constantly be doing that. And I don't think you look at my piece, it's not a tweet. If I could just save the world, save the earth, you know, well, I can say that. You know, I can put a hashtag on that. But I need a piece of music to reflect on Orion floating above the town when a proto-fascist whose climate policies may very well bring about the end of our species ascends to the presidency of the United States with the biggest megaphone in the world. That's an emergency. But the earth is still bigger than that, and nature is still bigger than that, and we're still bigger than that.
Mm.
We can still do something about that.
I think fundamentally just the role of art can be to get people to take pride and ownership of the natural world, to feel wonder. I mean, that's the thing. This is the perspective I've always taken, is that natural beauty serves no purpose whatsoever. It just is. It's there. It's not beautiful in and of itself. We are here to find it beautiful. We're here. And if you cultivate that sense of wonder and awe and love of the natural world, then you can get people to conserve it.
Mm.
You can't conserve something that you don't love.
And I think in your piece, this notion of better a wounded wilderness than none at all, it's also a kind of consolation, a stream of hope in that this is what we need to continue preserving. All hope is not gone. Can you read the very final lines of the text still? Because I think it goes well with what has been discussed here.
Better a wounded wilderness than none at all. Those who haven't the strength to go into it can simply contemplate the idea, but only for so long as we keep the remainder of our wild as a reserve and a promise, a part of the geography of hope.
You have been listening to the podcast Voices of Earth by the chamber choir Audite. You can find out about our future concerts from our webpage at the address audite.fi. And you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram.